Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, April 27, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is the following: Obama's Saudi connection. The Obama-Saudi alliance. I can add London to that, too, I think. And I'm very glad we have here live with us in the studio Will Wirtz. Welcome, Will.
Thank you, Marcia. It's good to be here.
And Will, many of you know, but he is he's a longtime associate of Lyndon LaRouche and many others of us. He is on the Executive Intelligence Review, that is EIR Online editorial board. But in particular, we welcome Will speaking with us for the next hour because he has been, among other things, focusing on assembling and compiling and putting forward the overall picture, a dossier-style picture of the dirty operations of the two kingdoms, you could call them, the British Empire London side and the Saudi Arabian side of world terrorism. Now, our title for this show is taken from a fact sheet that Will put together and was first posted on LaRouche Political Action Committee January 2nd this year, I believe.
Yeah, I believe so.
And then April 12th, it's been updated and posted. And just go on LaRouchePack.com, put in Wirtz, W-E-R-T-Z, and put in fact sheet, and you'll get this. And it's essential need to know for our situation, which we'll go into in a minute. But I have a few things I just want to give people by way of update before that. But first, let me focus this a little. You may have seen Will Wirtz interviewed in March on LaRouche Pack, LPAC TV, and it was called The 28 Pages, because the kind of thing that Will's fact sheet went into and other material that he's been putting out even before that concerns the fact that there have been 28 pages suppressed from the first report on what was behind the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attack on the United States, namely the Saudi connection. I won't go into that more now. But we have much is happening at a very fast pace now, and the point is we're in an endgame situation. It's not just a matter of the pouring forth of more particulars or which counts, but we are in the end phase of a fundamental clash between those behind such deliberate terrorism who in fact are behind the kind of imperial assault on the entire nation state system, even the idea of sovereignty by nations in order to serve the interests of their own population. So for the last 50 years, in economics terms, you've had these, I'll use parlor room jargon, you've had globalization, you've had so-called free trade. But in fact, the whole thing is blowing out. You have hyperinflation. You see what's happening in the transatlantic region of the absolute assault on the ability to exist of people in the Eurozone, as the Eurozone blows out. And so this is the end of the line. We have to stop what's behind this. It's do or die. And I just refer people, we may cover this again in our discussion in a few minutes, but one aspect of this has been the development for around three decades of the green myth of environmentalism, which really is just another a parallel to terrorism. It just asserts that the world's carrying capacity has been exceeded and we should get rid of several billion people. The British monarchy, I mean literally the Prince Philip, the Royal Society, the Queen, say the world has over 7 billion people, but we should only have 1 billion people. The rest have to go. And that brings us to the point to another way to look at the situation we have, where the economic the economy on which people depend is being destroyed, and we face, it's not terrorism for its own sake, we face the threat of war, thermonuclear war, by this continued deliberate strife. So we want to we're looking at what we, the nature of the enemy today, in order for us to mobilize, to retake, to take back the direction of our own nation here in the United States and create this opportunity internationally to collaborate with people and nations of goodwill. And that just brings me to the one update I want to give about our fight for reinstating Glass-Steagall, that is the original 1933 law for sound banking that worked for over six decades. We, as many of you who are regulars to listen to this weekly LaRue show, know that House the bill HR in the House of Representatives 129 will do the job. We have to, it needs to be introduced in the Senate. It has close to 60 signatures, at least 57, right, Will?
I think it's 57 as of about Thursday.
Okay. And we know that, as I say, many of you are listening or have been turning up the heat by having a wave of letters and demands for action in Washington come from states around the country. In 17 states, at least, that may change Monday or Tuesday. Actual texts of resolutions in the state legislature have been introduced in recent months, and more are pending. Rather than go through any lists, because that isn't exactly our subject today, this kind of action is taking place from Alaska to Louisiana, literally, and east to west too, Hawaii to Rhode Island. So the point about this is Congress has taken a spring break, I guess it's called, in the last 48 hours, and will not come back until May 6th. So May 7th and 8th, we have called, in terms of the LaRouche Political Action Committee and collaborators, a National Day of Action. It's actually a couple of days when Congress comes back, and this is the time we want to have it's Glass-Steagall or die, and make it, enforce it at that time. People are invited to come into Washington in person or otherwise have the equivalent impact through friends and relatives and everything. So this, keep that in mind, because your elected representative in Washington may be having town halls or picnics or doing other things in your vicinity, and it's time to do what you may have never done it in your life, but redouble anything to give them the orders of what needs done in Washington. Now, it's not a matter of economics is in one side, and then parallel to that are strategic issues of war and peace and terrorism. The same interests who set aside Glass-Steagall, who created hyperinflation, who created the blowout, and are enforcing their own will are the ones that are on this rampage to activate, deploy, to create networks to do such a thing as the Boston bombing or to do such the thing as other incidents like this. And that brings us around, Will, to ask you to start wherever you would like if you want to restate this point that it's a London-Saudi axis and President Obama is completely acting as a patsy and a functionary for that. That is the issue. If you want to start from there and then take it anywhere to make that clear. I'll just throw in here that your original fact sheet and then updates too concern the very blatant case of the attack on Benghazi from last summer.
Well, I think you addressed the issue very directly, which is that the British monarchy has a full commitment to committing genocide, reducing the world's population from approximately 7 billion to 1 billion in as rapid a period of time as possible. To accomplish that, they're basically pursuing two lines of attack. One is from an economic standpoint. You have the combination of zero-growth ideology, i.e. The green ideology, eliminate high technology, eliminate science, and at the same time, a policy of hyperinflation and a policy of genocidal austerity. That's the economic track. And what's missing in all of that is a basic policy of economic development, to overcome apparent limits to growth. And that requires Glass-Steagall. It requires a credit system. It requires investment in those forms of technology, which are capital intensive and can actually lead to high-paid, skilled jobs for the purpose of actually increasing the productive powers of the human mind. That's the issue. On the other hand, besides the economic policy, you have the war policy. And what we've seen the British doing is pushing for basically a policy of perpetual warfare. And what they've done is they've violated the very concept of national sovereignty, which is fundamental to the UN UN Charter. It's a fundamental principle coming out of World War II, actually going all the way back to the European Renaissance, Nicholas of Cusa, his work Concordancia Catholica, which established the principle in order to get us out of a period of 100 years war and a dark age. Back in the he wrote this work back in the 1430s, and it was the basis for the U.S. Constitution and Declaration of Independence. So they want to eliminate that and go with basically empire. You can call it New World Order, globalism, what have you. But that's the perspective that they're going with, and combined with that is a policy of human, basically of humanitarian interventionism, or right to protect as a violation of the principle of national sovereignty. So you can intervene in any country at any time over whatever pretext. Now, we saw what happened in Iraq when Tony Blair, the British, put together their sexed up dossier to lie that they're weapons of mass destruction. And how many hundreds of thousands of people have died as a result of that lie carried out by Tony Blair, knowingly. And now where are we today? After Obama and the at the instigation, certainly of the British, in collusion with the French and the Saudis and other Gulf states like Qatar, UAE, we carried out an unconstitutional war in Libya. And what we've undone, what we've done through that is unleashed terrorism throughout Northern Africa, throughout the Middle East, and other areas of the world. And now, off of the Libyan adventure, we're on the verge of war in Syria. And again, here we have it. We've already had one example of the British lying that they're weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And now we have another case where the British, the French, Israelis are saying that they're weapons of mass destruction, i.e. chemical weapons being used in Syria. Now, of course, it was Syria that asked for a UN investigation of this because what they claimed is that the opposition had the chemical weapons. And the UN was supposed to send investigators to Syria to investigate this, and the team hasn't even gone there. And despite that, you have the British, the French and the Israelis and elements in the United States claiming that they have proof, never having gone there, that chemical weapons were used by the Assad government. So again, I mean, the question is, will the American people put up with a second war? Actually, there's more than two, but a second in the sense of Iraq and now possibly Syria, based upon a lie of weapons of mass destruction, or in this case, chemical weapons.
Yeah, so, just as you were, I mean, your point, as you indicated, you have many situations. The whole going into Afghanistan has itself the same ideology, the same surrounding circumstantial manipulation to say this would be the response, this is the right response to end terrorism. In fact, it's perpetual war.
Now, I think one of the most important things for us to understand is that one of the reasons that we're faced with such terror attacks as just occurred in Boston, You should also know that the French embassy in Tripoli, Libya, was also bombed last week, or earlier this week, is that the Saudi Arabian role in the original 9/11, 2001 attack was covered up. It was covered up by George W. Bush, Cheney, et al., and it was then covered up by Obama, who had promised the families of the victims during the 2008 campaign that he would declassify the 28-page chapter of the joint congressional inquiry into 9/11, which focuses on the Saudi involvement in 9/11, the original 9/11. And Bob Graham, former Senator Bob Graham, who's one of the co-chairmen of that congressional inquiry, on September 11, 2012, the same day that Benghazi was attacked, put out an op-ed in which he basically said, we've got to get to the bottom. We have to declassify these 28 pages. We have to continue the investigation into the Saudi involvement. And if we don't, then we have no guarantee that the networks which were part of facilitating the original 9/11 don't still exist. Now, there is ample evidence of the Saudi involvement in 9/11. The Saudi ambassador to the UN, to the United States at that time, was Prince Bandar. And what you have to realize about Prince Bandar is that he has a long history of running dirty covert operations, which obviously includes the support of the Afghan opposition to the Soviet Union, which obviously gave rise to not only Al-Qaeda, but to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. In the 1980s, when the U.S. Congress cut off funding to the Contras, Bandar provided the funding to the Contras at the request of Bush Sr. And then we have the evidence. His wife, Haifa, who was the sister of Prince Turki, who was then head of Saudi intelligence, provided funds to a Saudi agent in San Diego by the name of Bohemi, I believe is his name. Mm-hmm. Who welcomed the first two of the 9/11 hijackers to come to the United States, set them up in San Diego, and so forth. So this the money trail exists to Prince Bandar, and it's one of the things that would probably come out if the 28 pages were declassified. And of course, Representative Walter Jones is pushing for that at this point. So there's an ongoing initiative to get to the bottom of this. And then what do you have? There's evidence now that as early as March 2011, and remember the Libyan opposition began its move to overthrow Gaddafi in February 2011. In March 2011, Obama, according to a reporter with Britain's publication The Independent, approached the Saudis and asked them to provide weapons to the opposition. Eventually, we know that Qatar and UAE, two other Gulf states, did so. At that time, Bandar, the same Bandar, was head of the National Security Council of Saudi Arabia. He is now head of intelligence at Saudi Arabia and is providing support for Al-Qaeda in Syria. Now, what also came out is that some individual who goes under the name of Guccifer hacked a number of emails from Sidney Blumenthal to Hillary Clinton. One of those was written in February of this year, and it basically lays out that the French intelligence reports that that both Benghazi and the later terrorist attack in Algeria were funded by wealthy Sunni Islamists from Saudi Arabia. And that this is known not only by the French intelligence, which told the Algerian intelligence, but when Algerian intelligence met with Libyan intelligence, they found out that the Libyan intelligence had the same information. So what do we have here? We have Saudi Arabia funding the original 9/11. We have Saudi Arabian wealthy Sunni Islamists, and this is a top-down kingdom. You don't have individuals just doing things on their own, funding Benghazi. So what are we doing in alliance with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, in trying to overthrow Assad, when these same people are the people who were behind the original 9/11 attack on the United States, behind the attack on our mission in Benghazi in September 11, 2012? What Saudi Arabia should be declared a state sponsor of terrorism. And if we have any you know, they are the face of the enemy, and they work directly with the British, because of course, one of the ways in which these operations have been run is as a result of what was called the Al-Yamama weapons deal between BAE Systems and Saudi Arabia, and basically it was a kickback scheme in which a big slush fund was created, and Prince Bandar got fees as a result of this deal, and those are the funds that have been going into these kinds of terrorist operations. And you look at Boston. I mean, one of the things that stares you in the face is that the whole terrorist movement in the Caucasus, including Chechnya and Dagestan, which is where the two brothers who were responsible for Boston come from, this whole area is the terrorists there are funded by Saudi Arabia. So and reflect the extreme so-called religious ideology of Saudi Arabia, which is called it's a Wahhabi so-called religion. So this is the reality of the matter is that this is what has to be gone after. And one of the problems we have is that we've had numerous reports which have been done in terms of Benghazi. Some information has come out. There is a move to create a select committee. Frank Wolf has a House Resolution 36, which now has 129 sponsors. No Democrats, unfortunately, only Republicans. But that's over half the Republican conference. The issue here is: are we going to get are we going to pull the plug on this British Saudi war policy? Through Benghazi and through getting declassifying these 28 pages on Saudi Arabia involvement in the first 9/11, or are they just going to put up a show in their investigations? One of the problems is people like John McCain, Lindsey Graham. They say we want to get to the bottom of Benghazi, but they don't really want to get to the bottom of Benghazi because they're essentially advocating launching war against Syria with Saudi Arabia. And how could you get to the bottom of Benghazi if you're not willing to face the fact that Saudi Arabia was behind Benghazi as they were behind the original 9/11?
Are they also, or the kind of thing you say, the false, completely false non-patriotism of saying, well, we'll hang it on Hillary Clinton's malfeasance, when in fact it's staring in your face the pedigree of these networks. You just talked about Saudi Arabia. Let me ask one thing about pedigree, because in the sweep you just indicated of Saudi money going into the Caucasus, into the different places and funding schools and on the basis of this 18th century Wahhabist fundamentalist kind of operation here. It was London all along who would then harbor certain groups, figures, and individuals and give safe haven, particularly to Chechnya. And I think that EIR, you may have done this in December 2000, just before the year 2001 in which the attack took place on the World Trade Center, that what happened is EIR submitted a list of those groups and individuals being harbored in London, especially in connection with terrorism in the Caucasus. And so the record is very clear and long of this kind of collaboration. It goes back decades earlier.
Yeah, the British policy is we'll give you political asylum if you carry out your terrorist operations outside of Britain. So that's the condition. And you look at Libya. The opposition to Gaddafi that Britain, French, Obama supported was a group called the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, LIFG. This group was created in Afghanistan when they were fighting with al-Qaeda and the Taliban, Libyans who had gone there. And they came back, and in 1995-96, the British MI6 approached them, and many of them lived in the UK at that time, and basically proposed that they carry out a coup against Gaddafi. And they tried to do that for approximately 3 years and failed. And then they dispersed to various other locations, including back to Afghanistan and Pakistan. This group was designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the UN, by the State Department, by the United Kingdom, through at least 2011. In 2007, the leadership of al-Qaeda made a public announcement that the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group had affiliated with al-Qaeda. The emir of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, a fellow by the name of Belhaj, was suspected of involvement in the Casablanca suicide bombing in 2003 and in the Madrid bombings in 2004. And yet this is the guy who became the head of the Tripoli Military Council when Gaddafi was thrown out of Tripoli. When Qatar provided and UAE provided guns and ammunition to Benghazi, it was provided not to the Transitional National Council, which had been recognized internationally, but it was provided to the LIFG and to Belhaj, which strengthened their position domestically within Libya. So that's who we allied with, al-Qaeda. And it was part of a strategic alliance, because after Gaddafi was overthrown, Gaddafi was killed October 2011. In that same month, the head of the Transitional National Council of Libya, Jalil, met with the leader of the Syrian opposition, and they worked out an agreement to send arms and Libyan fighters to Syria. In November, Belhaj went to Turkey to meet with the Syrian Free Army. In that same time period, weapons were being shipped to Syria through Turkey. And then in December, there was an agreement reached in Libya, in Tripoli, Libya, between Jalil, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood Party in Tunisia, Belhaj of the LIFG, the second in command of the Muslim Brotherhood of Syria, to go into Syria to overthrow Assad. And you have to realize that although it's not known whether Saudi Arabia directly provided weapons to the Syrian opposition, it is known that Qatar did and the UAE did. And according to the New York Times, Obama approved their sale of weapons to the opposition, to al-Qaeda, to the LIFG, affiliated with al-Qaeda, on the foreign terrorist organization list. And the only condition was that they not be U.S. weapons that they send, but that which would be traceable back to Obama, but that they be made in other countries. So they did that. And the UN in 2012, and then again just recently, wrote two reports in which they came to the conclusion that UAE and Qatar violated the UN arms embargo. And that was done with Obama's approval. And actually, in the case of Saudi Arabia, solicitation. So he violated the UN arms embargo. That's Obama, among other things. And then you look at Benghazi, and what do you find out? You find out that Ansar al-Sharia, the head of it, is al-Qaeda and LIFG. His name is Ben Kumu. He was in Guantanamo for a number of years and then sent back to Libya. And then he was released by Gaddafi as part of a deal that was imposed on Gaddafi by Tony Blair. Then you look at the people on, and it's also proven that al-Qaeda in Maghreb was involved. The recent report from five House committees came out this week states that it has other short it has major shortcomings the report, but it does state that. Then what you have to do is look at who are the people who are protecting the embassy, and what you find out is that they are all LIFG and Al Qaeda. The February 17th Brigade, which we hired to protect the mission. Was created by Belhaj and by another person by the name of Ismail al-Salabi. The Libya Shield, which met our reinforcements, which flew in from Tripoli at the airport and delayed their going to the aid of the CIA annex, this is headed by Wassam bin Hamid, who fought against us in Iraq. And according to a Library of Congress report, he is possibly the head of al-Qaeda in Libya. And also earlier in 2012, he had hosted a major demonstration in the city of Sirte. And the guest of honor was the head of al-Qaeda in Maghreb, Mokhtar Belmokhtar, the person who later ran the terrorist attack in Algeria in the gas fields.
The hostages and
the hostage taking and so forth. So he was there. Mokhtar Belmokhtar, is reported, was in Libya for a period of 4 to 5 months, and he was hosted by this guy from the Libya Shield, which was providing security for our forces. Those are probably the most. There are further evidence along these lines, but that's the. Those are the most prominent cases. The one person who is apparently in custody right now for Benghazi, Faraj al-Shalabi, is, according to the Libya press, a member of al-Qaeda and of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the group that we supported. So, and now what's happening in Syria? Obama's meeting with the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia. He's meeting with the emir of Qatar. He's meeting with UAE. In the period in which you're building towards an escalation against Syria on the grounds of use of chemical weapons, which has not been proven. So this is what we're facing right now. And the only thing I would like to stress is that it's crucial that even as we fight to get Glass-Steagall, that we get Obama out, and before we have thermonuclear war, and we have the evidence to do that, and there are a number of initiatives in the Congress, which if we could get the Congress to have any spine, could actually result in defusing this war danger, and specifically there's the following: there's the drive for a select committee to investigate Benghazi with 129 co-sponsors as of Friday. There is the drive by Walter Jones to get the 28 pages on Saudi Arabia's involvement in the original 9/11 declassified. As inadequate and full of shortcomings as the recent House report was on Benghazi, the Oversight Committee, which has done some good work in the past, is scheduling hearings in May.
Is this the same committee, maybe you want to say something about it, that had the raising of the Saudi involvement this week at a hearing, Dana Rohrabacher from California?
That's a different committee. That I believe, and also Poe.
I guess it was a joint committee.
I believe, well, I'm not sure. Actually, I think it may have been the Foreign Affairs Committee. But what Rohrabacher did, which was quite useful, contrary to people like McCain and Lindsey Graham, what he basically said is that we should be working much more closely with the Russians against the promotion of Wahhabite religious fanaticism, which is being sponsored by Saudi Arabia. And he basically said, is Saudi Arabia, is this ideology which is resulting in the killing of children? Remember, the Chechen terrorists have carried out horrible atrocities also in Russia. So Rohrabacher said, you know, we should be going after this policy of Saudi Arabia, in working closely with the Russians on this. And, of course, in the Boston case, if we had listened to the Russians, perhaps this thing could have actually been stopped before it even happened. I think that the base – and then the other thing which is happening is that there's a – as part of the continuing resolution for of the Defense Authorization Act, which was signed into law on March 26th by Obama, an amendment was passed which sets up a review of the implementation of recommendations by the 9/11 Commission and the FBI following the original 9/11. But it's not just a review. It also allows for an investigation of new evidence which has emerged since the original reports. And it's quite a bit in terms of Saudi involvement. It's not just the Prince Bandar involvement in terms of his wife funding the Saudi agent who set things up for the first two hijackers, but there was also another wholesale in Sarasota, Florida, which the FBI knew about, but which they didn't tell the Joint Congressional Inquiry about. There is also a whole cell that was operating in Paterson, New Jersey, and also in Falls Church, Virginia.
Do you want to say, I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, but this point too, you've reviewed the book by the gentleman Philip Marshall from a year ago, but who then his two sons were killed. Well, it's called A Murder Suicide in February. He's the one that a great deal more came out in this, right?
Right. Well, the point that this is his name is Philip Marshall. He wrote a book on 9/11. The Big Bamboozle, I think it was called.
Big Bamboozle. I think it's 9/11 and the War on Terror.
And what this guy has a history of being a pilot, a captain on commercial jets, specifically Boeing jets, the same that were used on 9/11. So he has some familiarity with the technical aspects of what would have been required in order to carry out the 9/11 attack. And he also had some experience going back to Iran-Contra because he was a pilot for what was his name
Barry Seal,
who was involved in Iran in the Contra operation and was actually killed back in I forget the actual year, but in the 1980s. So he has some knowledge of that side of the matter too. And what he goes through what would have been from a technical standpoint, because there was no technical aviation experts testified before the 9/11 Commission. And he has this knowledge. So he went through it and he basically said, listen, these guys were trained in small airplanes. And then they used simulators. But he said, none of the flight instructors who instructed them prior to 9/11 believed that they would have been capable, based upon that, their training, of carrying this thing out. Because you're talking about huge planes with very complicated procedures that would have to be carried out in order to do what they did. And so his conclusion is that they had to have had training. They had to actually have flight experience and training to carry out these maneuvers. And one of the things that he points to is that a number of the hijackers took trips to Las Vegas prior to 9/11. The only hijackers who took trips out there were the pilots, none of the other hijackers. And so what he did is he looked at, well, could they have gotten any kind of training in the general area of Las Vegas to Tucson, Arizona? And there is an air base in that area, which he thought could actually provide such training, because there were Boeing jets on the site. Also, it's a particular airport or air park that is known to have been used by the CIA and also by Blackwater previously. And the other thing which he points out is that it's been reported that after 9/11, the only planes that were allowed to fly out of the United States were planes which carried about 140 Saudis, including members of the bin Laden family who were in the United States at the time, back to Saudi Arabia. But what he points out is that there were two commercial jets which left Las Vegas right after 9/11. And that among the people who were on those planes was Prince Turkey. Prince Turkey was the head. I think he was actually replaced about a week beforehand as head of Saudi intelligence. But he was previously the head of Saudi intelligence. And of course, Prince Bandar was a top gun pilot for the Saudi Royal Air Force as well. So he had some experience in this kind of area. So, you know, this is what we need to get to the bottom of. And it's the elephant in the room. The British-Saudi operation, which Obama is part of, and, you know, that's what's responsible for Benghazi. It is responsible for 9/11 before that. And why are we covering this up? Why are we covering up the British Empire and the Saudi Kingdom in all of this? Now you should know there was a civil suit brought by families of the victims of 9/11 and also some insurance companies brought against Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and it was thrown out. However, there was recently another case which laid the basis for that dismissal being appealed, and it is on appeal right now. Obviously, if that dismissal is reversed, then that case then becomes quite live. In terms of Obama, I'd also like to point out that you've got, of course, what's been going on. What happened with Benghazi is a certain kind of international fast and furious. Yeah. The hypocrisy of Obama is just unbelievable, because he's running around talking about the need for gun control when he's the one whose administration provided assault weapons to the Sinaloa drug cartel in Mexico, which killed at least one Border Patrol officer and hundreds of Mexican citizens. And then he urges Saudi Arabia to provide weapons to the opposition in Libya in violation of the UN arms embargo. And whether they did or not, Qatar and UAE did, in violation of the arms embargo, and he approved it. And now what you have is Kerry running around in you know, basically in Turkey last Saturday with the Friends of Syria, pushing with Britain and Saudi Arabia, France, among others, for a provision of lethal as well as – well, basically lethal by other people, non-lethal by the United States. But it's like saying, well, we'll provide you with the night vision equipment.
Yeah, flak jackets and vests.
And the vests.
Armored vehicles.
And the other guy, you know, will provide you – or Saudi Arabia will provide you with the actual weapons. But of course, all of that leaves out the fact that there are weapons being smuggled from Libya, and have been smuggled there all along. So, that's the hypocrisy of this. And I just point this out because there was a hearing on Wednesday in the federal court in Washington, D.C., where Eric Holder had a motion to dismiss a civil suit brought by the House of Representatives due to the fact that he was in contempt of Congress by not providing subpoenaed documents on Fast and Furious. And the judge basically said, I mean, the Department of Justice argued, oh, the court should not be involved in this whatsoever. This should just be resolved between the House and the executive, which means that the executive doesn't hand over the documents, right? And the judge said, DOJ general counsel said, well, it's a question of checks and balances. And the judge said, who was an appointee of Obama, well, I'm checks and balances too, and the third branch of government exists. And so it looks very much as if she's going to reject that dismissal. But so you have a number of things converging, which could result in Obama being driven from office.
Just on that point too, because there was another instance this week. It's almost as if Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, who is the flunky and covering and lying and saying too bad, so sad, I'm just going to defend whatever Obama and London want, people should understand he's almost persona non grata in certain quarters on Capitol Hill. He was asked. I think a hearing was shut down. You may say more about it, so people can know what you're calling this convergence point.
Yeah.
It's powerful. It's not merely accumulation of passive information. We're at a point of potential shift.
Well,
was that Frank Wolf?
Yeah,
maybe?
He was. Frank Wolf is head of an appropriations subcommittee.
Oh, that's right.
Responsible for oversight of the budget of the Department of Justice. And Holder was before his committee last week. Previous week. And Holder basically was not prepared to answer about 91 questions that had been submitted to him. Wolf said, "Well, okay, well, you can answer them in writing, but I have to insist upon a deadline." And Holder wouldn't agree to that. So at that point, Frank Wolf just was totally exasperated and said, forget it. You know, I'm not going to pay attention to you. Hearing adjourned. And so Holder was all freaked out and basically said, no, I can stay a little bit longer, because he was claiming that he had to go to another hearing. So Wolf basically adjourned the meeting twice on Holder because of his complete lack of any sense of his constitutional responsibilities to congressional oversight. And remember, it's Holder who also was involved in his office and the legal opinions justifying drone extrajudicial killings, including of American citizens.
I'll throw it all in. And also the non-prosecution of any Wall Street of any banker, the
right.
Non-indictment, the non-jail sentencing, the no, do no time, do no wrong. It's Eric Holder again, who even says so. We can't jeopardize. Go ahead.
It's actually his doctrines, the Holder
doctrine. Oh, excuse me. I think, yeah, right. Yeah. He gives speeches on it in academic circles, how it would hurt the system.
I mean, everybody knows that this administration has actually gone further than Bush. Which doesn't let Bush off the hook, or Cheney, but it does underscore the fact that this administration has a complete contempt for the U.S. Constitution. They're operating on the basis of the theories of Carl Schmitt, who was the crown jurist who defended Adolf Hitler and his seizure of power. The basic idea that you have a unitary executive, that the ruler is both the legislature and also the judiciary, and that's what you have. The Department of Justice goes in to this judge and says that the court should not become involved in deciding this suit. You have the drone policy, and that's the best example of it, because the president is, in that case, essentially the accuser the judge, the jury, the prosecutor, and the hangman. Well, that's the executor. I already said it. But that's the ideology. That was the ideology of Bush. But even Bush went to the U.S. Congress before going to Iraq. I mean, it was based on a lie, but at least he paid, you know, he did do that, which Obama has not done. Bush carried out torture in terms of waterboarding. But Obama's killing people, and he's killed thousands of people. And including the so-called signature strikes, which involve collateral damage, where you don't even know whether there's somebody that is actually worthy of being targeted. So the point is, this guy has got to be forced out of office through the threat of impeachment or be impeached. Doing that can't hurt getting Glass-Steagall. And similarly, obviously, getting Glass-Steagall and fighting for that, given that Obama and the British Queen are thoroughly opposed to Glass-Steagall, because they're into the policy of predatory banking policies for the purpose of genocide. So you get Glass-Steagall, that's also going to bring down Obama.
Yeah, I think
in that kind of situation where the urgency of it is what's going on now with Syria, and also what's going on with Europe. I mean, not to mention here, but what with Europe in terms of the level of unemployment, the level of austerity, the lack of medical treatment. I mean, this is a harbinger of what's going to come here unless we turn this around. But right now, genocide is being committed in Europe with these kinds of policies. Think about it. Official 27% plus unemployment in Spain. Think of what happened in Cyprus, or they just went in and stole money from people's savings accounts. And and people should just be aware that is embedded in Dodd-Frank. Title II of Dodd-Frank calls for what is the language is a bail in instead of a bail out. So, and the bail in means taking deposits. And that's the policy that we're going to be facing here. It's already being faced in Europe. This is what has to, the time is really running out. And it's crucial that, the reality of the crimes of Obama is brought to bear.
Right. In fact, you mentioned about Europe, this situation where over 50-60% of the young people, not just the general, have any opportunity of any kind of lousy job. It's a horrendous situation, and the Obama administration, in the midst of this, is proposing, besides a trans-Pacific partnership, a new transatlantic free trade partnership. Well, this is death. They're saying black is white, snow is black. Just what you say. The made up names like signature drones, meaning kill when you want. Make a list every week. We could continue to list that and chronicle that, but yet the opportunity at this time of an endgame situation is never greater, as you've alluded to or made reference to about the low regard of any of Obama's representatives, Eric Holder, anyone else. So we have the potential to force the shift. What I was talking about at the beginning, the next few days, lawmakers may be the first week of May back in their home districts or otherwise reachable. You can corner them, corral them, ambush them, and then bring everything to bear when they're back in Washington, coming back May 6, 7. And because I suppose you could say, well, you've been putting together, as I said, dossiers and material and coverage and expose, but it is coming together. It is converging. That right. that it's it's undeniable. So it's a question of then of providing the leadership to take action
right,
against
it. Right, of acting on it. And I, let me just say, the you have to have an historical view of this situation. And again, what we're dealing with here is the contrast between empire and a republic, constitutional republic, such as we have uniquely. And obviously, that goes back to, in a certain sense, that the historically to the distinction between Plato and his notion of man as capable of creativity, that's his fundamental nature, versus Aristotle, who basically didn't think that man was capable of creativity, and Aristotle served the interests of empire. And then you look at the period of in Europe during the really the Hundred Years' War and the Black Death of the plague, a dark age of over 100 years. And this was enforced by a Venetian system which followed on the Roman empire system, in which human beings were not treated as created in the image of the creator, i.e. were not treated from the standpoint of developing their creative potential, which is what a constitutional republic is dedicated to. Because the empire knows that if people develop their minds that, and a society is organized on that principle, then, in fact, they lose their control. So they have to keep people dumbed down. They have to basically keep the population reduced because, obviously, they're threatened by an increase in population and particularly by intelligence. So, you know, how do we get out of that Hundred Years' War and Dark Age? It was through Kuz's concept of man created in the image of the creator, Imago Viva Dei. And that's really the fundamental issue today. It's our constitutional principle, and it's what people must have passion about, because if you have passion about that, then you're not going to you're basically not going to allow humanity to be destroyed by the Queen of England or her stooges like Obama, and you're going to be able to distinguish between a person who's here you have Obama. He gets the Nobel Peace Prize. He's people run around supporting him. Well, how can you support somebody who's actually committing the crimes that he's committing? You can't do that. And if you really believe that man is created in the image of the creator, you just can't do it. And as Lyndon LaRouche was saying today in a discussion we had with him, I mean, the fundamental issue is we have to really help free – in freeing ourselves, we have to help free Europe right now, because Europe is being thoroughly destroyed. And remember, of course, our forefathers came here to us actually at the initiative of Kuza, because of the oligarchical control of Europe. But there's also it was Kuz's ideas in the Renaissance which were the positive contribution of Europe to our constitutional republic and what we have. And the point that Lyndon LaRouche made is that a justice to one is a justice injustice to one is an injustice to all. And that we have a responsibility to free Europe from the British Empire, because right now we need Europe as an ally, and right now Europe is absolutely being destroyed, and then there are those idiots who are acting on behalf of Britain who are trying to impose the same kinds of policies which have destroyed Europe upon us. So this is a crucial moment in all of history right now, and I think that's the it just requires a redoubling of commitment on the part of everybody if we're going to survive.
Well, I heard that one of the representatives of the Federal House of Representatives in Wisconsin when an organizer talked to him about what we have to have with Glass-Steagall, and he said, yes, Glass-Steagall's the big hammer. So it is.
Right.
It is against all of this evil we're talking about historically today, and we have the opportunity to wield it. And so thank you, Will Wirtz, very much for being on. I ask everyone to look at that updated fact sheet if you haven't already. It's on LaRouche Pack. Go to World War III or go otherwise put in Wirtz, W-E-R-T-Z, and fact sheet on what he's been describing. But we will continue and with this discussion as necessary. But this is the big chance, and plan even to come into Washington in person if you're listening to this in the next few days for the May 7th and 8th National Day of Action. So this concludes the LaRouche Show for April 27th, 2013. Thank you.
Thank you.